as many people remember, when the original launch of healthcare.gov happened. So this was a big initiative under our previous president, Obama. And, you know, that was one of those cases where there were lots of different people working on lots of different pieces. And when it launched, it fell down almost immediately, and people couldn't log into the site, and they couldn't get their health benefits. And this big push and big initiative to get people healthcare kind of fell apart really quickly.
For all my women out there, I just want you to know that you are a boss. Women have to be at the table for technology and innovation. And if not, we'll simply create our own. Don't feel like you shouldn't be a part of the tech space just because there aren't many women in the room. That's exactly why we need you to be there. Girl, don't forget to rep your set in these tech spaces, aka rep your culture. You are the face of technology and the face of the future.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Women in Tech with Ariana podcast with me, Ariana, as your favorite host. For those of you, it's your first time tuning in. Welcome to an amazing community of women in tech from all around the world, where we talk about the latest news in technology, hear stories from women in tech, and share tangible resources and tools like access to funding, give away free materials to help you learn things like coding, job opportunities, talk about the conferences of the year that you definitely need to attend, and so much more. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button and leave a review in the podcast app or on the website you're using to currently listen to this episode. Today, guys, we have a super special guest, and I'm so excited. Today, we have Kat Drake. Kat currently works for the White House as the Director of Design for the United States Digital Service. Kat has 2 decades of experience as a user researcher and designer. Kat's previously worked for companies like Microsoft, Salesforce, Starbucks, and so many more. Kat, we are so excited to have you on the show today.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you and to your audience today.
So I had such a blast doing research on you, and I'm so excited for our listeners to get to know more about you, who you are, and all of your experience. So Kat, tell us about where you're originally from and where you're currently based.
Sure. So I grew up in New England, and right around the time that it was time to go off to college, I really was excited to get out of Portland, Maine, which is where I spent my formative years. And so I went from there to art school for a year in Georgia. And I decided that it wasn't quite a good fit for me in terms of what the offerings were and what I thought I might like to do with my life when I was done with school. So I found myself moving to Seattle, where I took a little time to get residency and then get an associate's degree. And then I transferred to the University of Washington in Seattle and did an industrial design degree there. And then spent, I would say, I think 11 years in Seattle. I was there for the first tech boom, which I can talk about a little bit. Some of those companies that you were listed are Seattle-based companies. So that's a little bit about my journey in that direction. And then I started thinking about wanting to go to graduate school, and I was feeling really drawn to go back to New England. So I did a couple years of grad school in Boston. And then from there, went into consulting for a couple of years with a large consulting company that at the time was called Avenue A Razorfish. And Razorfish has since been bought by Sapient, and I think that's what they're going by now. But they have large offices all over the world, I think, at this time, in various factions. And so consulting was a really great way to get my feet wet, working with lots of different kinds of technology and do a lot of client-facing work, which I've found has been very impactful on my career path. From there, I wanted to move back to the West Coast, and so I moved to San Francisco, was there for 4.5 years, primarily working with Salesforce, as you mentioned, as one of their only user researchers when I started. I think there was only one other person, and at the time, the company was about 2,300 people. And then when I left 4 years later, it was 10,000 people. So the impact of the growth there and what it was like to be doing research in that kind of a space, it was a very exciting time. There was also a lot of learning as I went and trying to find the right path in order to be able to have a voice of research in the rooms that we were in as we were developing technology. From there, I moved back to Seattle, and then in 2016, I started looking around for maybe what my next big step was going to be for work. And was really interested in the idea of civic tech, and that's how I found USDS. And so in December of 2016, I moved to DC. I never would have thought that I ever would have lived in Washington, DC. It was not on my radar at all. Yeah. And I've been here for the last 3 years.
That's awesome. So you've had quite a journey, right? Like experiencing all of these different areas and cities that are sound like primary tech hubs. So like, we're curious to know, like, what was like the beginning of your journey? Because you have a lot of experience in, you know, user research and design, and we're going to get more into detail about that. But like, what was the initial thing back to your earliest memory that kind of got you in this industry?
I mean, I can tell you a story from when I was in kindergarten, which is maybe a little, I don't, maybe too far back, but it's one of my earliest memories about that I think really held true to the designer that I am today, for better or worse, was being in kindergarten. And at the time, we were given Xerox sheets to color, and the Xerox machine was terrible at the school that we had. And so my kindergarten teacher required us as students, so as we were doing, before we started coloring, to do a heavy black crayon outline around what we were drawing. In my formative memory, this was a cow. And so it was a cow that was outlined in dark black crayon and then colored in. And I thought that the black crayon was ugly, and I didn't want to do it. And so I ended up, you know, in floods of tears, staying after school. And when I look back now, it's sort of the first time that I realized that I saw things a little bit differently than other people. It's interesting to note that neither of my parents remembers this happening at all, but it was like a pretty influential experience for me as a young child. But I do think I grew up in a household, my mom had been an art major, my dad was very much a tinkerer. And so there was always, you know, looking back, it's easy to see how that fosters a design mind and design thinking. You know, my dad's always been a critical thinker and was always taking computers apart and putting them back together. We had early series of gateway computers in my house growing up, which I didn't have particularly much interest in or access to, but I was surrounded by it on a regular basis. And then that, I think, fed into a natural curiosity about design. And when I was in high school, I did some studio art classes. And that was always the place that I felt really most at home, you know, math or English classes or foreign languages. I just didn't particularly excite me at the time, because I think I didn't really understand why those things were important. But my studio art teacher was somebody who was incredibly influential to me in high school. And so then that's how I naturally fell into, well, I think I'll go to art school because that's the place that I'm most comfortable.
Yeah.
And then when I got there, I started looking around at what was possible to do with a studio art degree, and was also watching a couple of my friends who had gone into industrial design specifically. And that, I think, it really hit me that was an opportunity to maybe be a little bit more impactful in building things that people would use.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where my path started. And then over time, I've just continued to add on to that skill set more and more and more. And then, you know, to seek out places that I wanted to learn more about. And being in and around first in the early 2000s was interesting, because you start to add and fold in the business side of things. So really understanding how a business works and how a startup works and what needs to happen for something to be successful. You know, how much of it is luck, how much of it is grit and determination, and then where my path fit in that journey. I think it's important to know that after having done this for a long time, I can tell a really good story backwards, but there were many times along the way that I was frustrated or confused or not sure about which step to take in terms of furthering my skill set against the technology and startup world. And so that's something I'd be happy to delve into a little bit, if that's interesting, because I think that that's something we all struggle with as technologists, yes, especially as people who are looking to get into the field or get started and aren't really quite sure how to navigate that.
Yes, definitely. We're definitely going to get into the career path because I get questions quite a bit from women. Like they'll DM me on Instagram or Facebook and ask me about how do they make, you know, this career change, right? And further their skill in technology and design. And that's literally what this podcast focuses on, is figuring out what are some tangible ways and tactics that women can use, right, to further their skills. Yeah. So what were some of the things that, you know, kind of helped you to develop, you know, further develop your skill when, as you talked about, you know, looking at, you know, yourself and your skill compared to like the technologists at the time, like what kind of helped you get to the next level that you believe that has like truly prepared you for the role that you have today?
So some of that is probably good standard advice. You know, I had some really great mentors along the way. I also had people who stood in my path, and so that's always, there's always kind of both sides of that to think about. I think in the early stages of my path, particularly for on the education side, I really kind of did what I thought I was supposed to be doing, and a little bit less about trusting my heart or my gut, which I think is, you know, the more mature I get, the more I can look back and see that clearly. I know that I couldn't see, you know, the forest for the trees at the time. One of the big moments for me, I think that helped set me on the path that I'm on today, is when I first graduated with an undergrad degree in industrial design. I was really fried. I was very much in debt with a lot of student loans, and there was a bit of a recession going on at the time, right before the first dot-com boom really took off. And so it was hard for my peers and myself to get hired into doing that work. I think industrial design has traditionally been a place where there are not a lot of women in that space. And, you know, that's true even still today, which is unfortunate, though I would say that with the advent of user experience as a role and a place for people to go and an approach and the way that people talk about this kind of design work, I think that really has opened up for lots of different kinds of roles and lots of different kinds of sets of expertise, as well as folks from novice to expert to find a place to land and to get started, which is really wonderful. But when I was coming out of school, my academic advisor at the University of Washington had left her job and had gone to work for a tech startup in Seattle. Wow. And she called me and she said, I think you should come and do this. And I was like, well, this isn't really what I just finished going to school for. So I'm not quite sure, you know, this feels a little funny to me. And she was like, no, just come and try it. Like this is, you know, the next wave. Everything is happening here. And we need people like you. And I liked the fact that she thought that I was smart and she was looking out for me. And so that's how I ended up at my first dot-com. 11 months after I joined, it was clear that dot-com was not going to survive. And so I ended up moving to a company that I was connected to because I had worked previously with somebody who worked there. And that company was kind of doing early days what we would probably look at as data acquisition now, or content strategy. It wasn't called that. It was lots and lots of data scraping off the internet manually and putting into Excel spreadsheets, which isn't particularly interesting given that like now we have lots of different kinds of technology that can do that for us. But that's what we were doing. And I ended up leading a team there. I had a really great boss. We had software developers in the room who were developing the proprietary software that we were using to gather this information from the internet. And then I ran a team that was doing the gathering. Pretty early on, I was sort of stymied by the idea that we had the software developers that were writing the software that people who were literally sitting on the other side of the room were using.
Right.
And wondering why there was less, you know, but watching my team kind of frustrated about what they were doing and having a lot of feedback to give.
Right.
And so I often compare that time to being the art major in the room full of engineers, because yeah. I knew that I was looking at things a little bit differently, but I didn't quite have the language to make the strong arguments that I felt like needed to be made. And yeah. that's how I found the path to user research, and that's what fostered my decision to go to graduate school, because I wanted the science. I wanted to have the stronger arguments. Again, and things have changed even now since that time. Right. I work with every day here at USDS, I work with a bunch of amazing software engineers that are super interested in design. They're super interested in what their users have to say and who's going to be using the products that they're building. So I think that approach has changed quite a bit, which is really wonderful to see happening. But that was kind of a pivotal moment for me, was that decision that I needed something else. And that put me on the path to try to find the words for what that was, and then to find a place where I could learn more about it.
That's awesome. So like you talked about, right, like your story of how, you know, you were exposed to a different side of user research, right? And you talked about understanding the science of user research and essentially the importance of user-centered design. Can you explain to us, you know, the impact and the importance of UI UX research and how it impacts technology?
Absolutely. So in the early days, before the tech universe that we know today, there was a lot of research that was done, particularly in government and military, for ergonomics and human factors. And that's kind of the beginning of the origin for things like usability testing and user acceptance testing, the things that we do now that are more widely understood. And so that a little bit of background of that is, and then there's a piece that has a lot to do with theology, psychology, sociology, anthropology, which is sort of the study of looking at people and how they do things. And so for a long time, I used to describe what I did as advanced people watching. And it's one of those things that can look really easy to people, which can make it challenging in a work environment, because you're making an argument for why we should be talking to users and why we should be building time in upfront to do that. Because the best product life cycles are not one and done, right? They're iterative. And so the sooner the team that you're working with to build whatever the product is, be it hardware or software, the sooner that you start talking to people who are going to eventually be using your tool, the better. And so early user research methodologies are going into talking with people about, like, what is it that you do today? So if we're about to build a thing that's going to do something, we want to know what people are doing in the absence of the thing. So how are they solving their problems today? What kinds of tools are they using? What sort of workarounds are they creating? And then even things like, what does their work environment look like? Is it noisy? Are they sitting in front of multiple monitors? Are they sitting in front of different terminals where they're entering information into one terminal and then having to turn around and enter that same information into a second terminal, right? Like what does all of that look like? And that's the beginning stages of really understanding who your users are and what they are currently doing.
Yeah.
And then building that into, okay, then what should we build and what do we need to take into account? Like what's the severity or what's the potential impact that we could have with the piece of the tool that we want to build. And then once you start doing that, cyclically going back and validating that the path that you're on for building these tools is actually makes sense to the people that you're building for. And so that's where you get into agile development practices, right? And where you're, or prototyping practices, if it's hardware, where you're doing something small and putting it into somebody's hands, getting some feedback, doing another iteration, putting it into people's hands, getting feedback. And over time, you'll find that a couple of things happen. And these are some of my favorite things about being a user researcher, is that one of those things is that your end users start to really feel invested in the work that you're doing together, because they see it as a collaboration. They find that when they are given the opportunity to give feedback, that they will really rise to the occasion and they will tell you what they think about things, which can be really super positive, even if the feedback that they're giving you is negative. Because then you've learned something and you can go back to your team and work with your product folks or your software developers and really be that voice of the user and help them understand what those use cases are.
Yeah, you...
No,
you answered it perfectly and gave so many different variety of things. And I loved like when you started to talk about like iterative product life cycles and, you know, like prototyping products. And so I'm in the startup world myself and I'm always, you know, sharing with my team of people who aren't developers. You know, I'm always explaining to them the importance of why, you know, prototyping early is so important. Like you said, you know, getting closer to your customer, doing that customer discovery research. And I think that there's so many people who have business ideas, right? They think this is how the design is supposed to look and this is how everything is going to flow. But then, you know, once you put it in front of someone, you realize that this is actually not the product that either your customer doesn't want or they really love the tool that they're currently using and they don't want to switch to anything else anyway. So you end up spending like all this time and money, right? Investing into something that, you know, who you think your customer is they don't even want the product. So no, you hit the nail on the hammer for sure on that. So you've previously worked for Microsoft as a design researcher for the Surface Pro 2, 3, and 4. What are some design tips that you can share with our listeners about developing physical products? And what part of your work with the Surface Pro do customers interact with?
Yeah, actually, it's interesting because that comes back to the point that you were just making about understanding your users. So when I started working on the Surface team, we were coming in and doing research with people who were using the first generation. So they had done a release of the Surface and the Surface Pro. And we were going out, like my first day, I think we went out and we're going into people's homes and talking to them about how they were using the Surface. And that was getting built into, you know, the idea is, of course, that that's going to be iterative and that's going to be built into the second, third generation. What's really interesting about, well, a fun aside story is that one of the things that we discovered, and this was something that I think hit the blogs and the like technology feedback pretty early on with the first generation of Surfaces, was how much people were using it for games. And that wasn't something that was expected. I think it was something that I don't think anybody really had considered that as a use case. We talked a lot about using it creatively as a use case. We talked a lot about using it to, for production and being productive because you could use it with all the other office suites. And so that was the idea. Gaming wasn't really in the picture. And so but what happened was that it really raised the bar for the second generation that we now knew that people were going to be using it for gaming and we had to understand a little bit about the how and the why. And so one of the best favorite studies that I did during that time was we ended up putting a whole bunch of people into a conference room at Microsoft and they were playing the game League of Legends. And the reason that we had chosen League of Legends is because it would tell you what the frame rate per second was on the screen. And so we could do a comparison against that and a bunch of other, we had a big device library. So we had lots of different other devices as well as our generation of devices. So I was running around watching everybody play this game and monitoring the frame rate of how quickly the second generation was in response to the first generation. And so we got to do a lot of fun user testing like that. One of the challenges of testing with physical hardware, specifically with electronic devices, is that there's a lot you can't learn until you have the full device in your hands. So as much as prototyping, you know, paper prototyping with software or physical prototyping, if you're building furniture, you can build a version, a prototype of that furniture and see if the size and the scale make sense. With electronics, everything, I mean, it pretty much has to be fully baked in order for you to know how all the pieces are going to work together. And so that's a really, it's a big challenge, I think, universally. And it was definitely a challenge for us at the time, because we didn't have, you know, we were working on the second and third generations. Much has changed since then. You know, they've gotten into some really interesting directions that they have gone. And, you know, they have started doing laptops and things now to, I think, hit on different kinds of use cases for what they know that their users are doing. But it was a real challenge to figure out, you know, even the weight of something, right? Like, you can build something that is the size and the shape of a surface, and you can hand it to somebody, and right. you can give them a prototype of a pen and ask them to imitate the way that they would take notes for something or select things. But not, you don't get a sense of, like, how heavy that device is actually going to be, right? Or what the response is going to be when the pen touches the surface of the device. And so the other, that those things added to the challenge of the fact that we were very much working in a pretty locked down space. And so because they were being very careful about when they were releasing these devices out, there was not, we couldn't really talk about them a lot outside of the buildings that we were working in. And so we needed to do a lot of the user testing that we did internally, which is, you know, I'm a strong believer that any kind of research and any kind of way that you can talk to people who are going to interact with your product is good. There were still some unknowns every time you would release this out into the wild, because you hadn't had a chance to get a lot of feedback from, you know, what you or I would maybe call the average person who would be purchasing one of these devices to do their work in some capacity.
That's really good. Like you talked about, right? Like the challenge of, you know, if you're building this product, you know, you really don't know like all the ins and outs and how it's really going to work until, for physical products at least, you know, how it's going to work and function with your user. So, of course, you know, getting user feedback, talking to the customer. What are some other ways, if I'm someone who's listening and I'm building an electronic product and I don't know, maybe it's a new headphone or a new TV, just, you know, giving a random example, but this is something that, you know, it's kind of hard to test and understand if my customer is going to truly like it until they have the physical product in their hand. What would be some ways you would say a person can, you know, ensure or at least streamline the process of, you know, how do they make sure they're getting as close to possible, you know, that their design and that their technology is going to work, you know, before they actually, you know, get it to the manufacturer and it's, you know, produced 1,000 times?
Yeah, I think a lot of it depends on the size of the company. So when you're working on something like a Surface device, you've got lots of different teams working on very small pieces. And so the best thing that you can do in that sort of environment is get those people working together as much as possible, where it's not, you're not handing something off over a wall or over a silo. You're putting everybody in a room together, at least on a somewhat regular basis, and looking for where the connection points are. Mm-hmm. When you're working on something that is more maybe meant for a smaller audience, or, you know, like I'm thinking like really fancy headphones, right? Or something that's gonna have a particular type of user, then the best thing that you can do is get to know that user as well as you can, even before you put pen to paper for prototypes. Yeah. And then I think it's just continuing to iterate generatively. And that can be something that, you know, as a consumer, it can be really frustrating, because when you think about every time a new iPhone comes out, or every time, you know, we have a little bit of a process going now with consumerism that is planned obsolescence, right? That you notice that when the newest version of something comes out, it always seems like your battery starts to die sooner on the one that you have. And that kind of drives you to wanting to get another one. And one of the things that, you know, aspirationally, I would love to see our industry paying attention to is what the life cycle of those products is, right? Yeah. Because that, especially for the physical devices, because that really contributes to our impact on the world. And there are lots of different ways to be a creative problem solver in that space that I think we've barely started to scratch the surface.
Yeah. I can't tell you how like annoying it is every time my phone dies like every 15 minutes. So I completely agree that that is a problem that we need to solve, and Kat will use you to spearhead that project for the world to solve it. But okay, guys, we'll be really quick. We are going to have a quick commercial break and we'll be back with Kat Jurek. Super quick commercial break, guys. This year, we're doing something totally different for the Women in Tech with Ariana podcast. We get quite a few women who reach out and want to be on the show. So we've decided to launch the Women Around the World highlight series, where we will feature women in tech, and you get to talk about your business or your nonprofit and how you're making an impact on your community. So we'll be providing exposure to our global audience for your business or your nonprofit. If you're interested in being a part of this highlight series for our podcast, send us an email at podcast@walwaytech.com with the subject line Women Around the World, and our podcast team will send you details. Welcome back, guys. We are with Kat Jurek. She is the Director of Design at the United States Digital Service. So, Kat, thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So our next question that we have for you, Kat, is what is the United States Digital Service? You know, how did the USDS get started, and what kind of impact are you guys making on the lives of Americans across the nation?
Yeah, great question. So the United States Digital Service is a little more than 5 years old. So the big part of our origin story that we like to tell is many people remember when the original launch of healthcare.gov happened. So this was a big initiative under our previous president, Obama. And, you know, that was one of those cases where there were lots of different people working on lots of different pieces. And when it launched, it fell down almost immediately, and people couldn't log into the site and they couldn't get their health benefits. And this big push and big initiative to get people healthcare kind of fell apart really quickly and rapidly. And so at the time, the decision was made to bring in a number of technologists, primarily software developers from private industry. So essentially going out to places like Silicon Valley and saying, hey, we need some help. And so there were a number of software developers in a room for a couple of weeks working night and day and trying to get the back end stood back up again and functioning in a way that was going to be more sustainable for the volume of people that were hitting that site. And at the end of that effort, you know, the people involved kind of looked around and said, hey, like, this is kind of a good idea. Like, maybe we should find a way for folks from private industry to come and serve in various aspects of the federal government. And, you know, as you know, if you've interacted with any kind of federal government services, there's a lot of antiquated technology, and there are a lot of pushes at different agencies around government for modernization efforts. And it can be a bit of a challenge for some things that haven't been updated in quite a while, or were maybe built a number of years ago, to be able to, you know, if you do the same thing that you've always done, you kind of get the same results, right? And so we kind of serve as a little bit of a catalyst or a different perspective, a different way of thinking. And so that's how the United States Digital Service was born. And so now we have about 180 people. We have folks that come from engineering, from design, from product development. We also have folks that are really great at procurement, because contracting in government is something that I didn't really ever understand how that worked until I got here, but it's incredibly impactful on the end result of what gets built in that is used by people around the United States. So the model that we work under is a little bit, it's kind of like the Peace Corps. Sometimes we compare it to being a Peace Corps for nerds. So people come from private industry, though not everybody is coming from Silicon Valley. We have people coming from all over the United States. And we have also people coming from inside of government too, who find us and are interested in the way that we work. So we do what we call a tour of duty, which involves people coming for short periods of time. We've had people come for as little as 3 months, up to typically for design, it's about 2.5 years right now. And then we max out at 4 years. And so the idea with that is that we're constantly bringing new infusions of problem solvers and different kinds of expertise into our teams. And then we are going out and partnering with many different agencies across the federal government. So places like Health and Human Services, where we still have a team, you know, 5 years later after the healthcare work that we did. We're at DHS, we're at the Department of Veterans Affairs, we're doing work with the Social Security Administration. In the past, we've done work with Small Business Administration, with the Department of Education, with the IRS. So we really, there's a lot of diversity in the kinds of approaches that we're taking, in the sizes of the teams and the types of work that we're doing. But the gist of it is essentially to bring technologists in from around the United States and give them an opportunity to work with our government partners to find new approaches to some of the technological work that they are doing.
Now we're curious to know more about what are some of the projects that are being developed by the United States Digital Service, right? So the USDS, you know, you talked about there are different areas of focus from for building technology, whether it's healthcare, you know, farmers, veterans, small business owners, and many others. But you know, one of the focuses that I in my research that I saw was the Department of Defense. Can you tell us about the challenges that the USDS design team has had to solve for the DoD?
Sure. I'm happy to talk about that. The other thing that I should make sure to mention is that because the United States Digital Service is such a small group of people, right? We're less than 200 people, and we're working in very small teams around these different agencies. The bulk of the work that we are able to contribute to is primarily done by the good folks who are on the ground at these agencies already. And so working in collaboration with the folks that are there helps us really embody one of our values, which is to empower people. And so a lot of the work that we're doing is driven by the people that are already there and the partnerships that we're able to work with them. So we typically at USDS don't produce a lot of product work independently, because we're spending our focus working with the agencies there to help them find a way to build the things that they need to build. But you asked about the work at DoD. So my first year and a half that I was with the United States Digital Service, I was working on the DoD team. And at the time that I joined, again, you know, this story is kind of repeated throughout my path personally. But at the time, they had, I think, one designer on the team. It was very engineering forward at the beginning when I joined at the end of 2016. And over time, we were able to build up the design capacity on that team by kind of proving the value of what design could do in some of the conversations and some of the rooms that we were in. But one of the projects that I personally worked on, and I think I've talked about this a little bit in the past publicly before was the project by that is the software behind how people join the military. So from the time a young recruit walks into a recruiter's office and gives some of their information to a military recruiter, regardless of what their service is, to the point that they go off to boot camp, there's one system that kind of drives holding all of that data and making sure that that data is shared with the service that they might be joining, so be it Air Force or the Marines or the Army. And that system had, at the time, the product person that we had working on it used to joke that the software was older than he was, which was actually turned out to be true. It had been attempted to update a number of times over the last maybe 15 years. And for one reason or another, it just wasn't able to be successful for lots of different reasons. And some of that I spoke about earlier, that it's really hard sometimes to change these big infrastructure systems, because you can't just change one, you can't super modernize one small piece of it. You really have to take into account the end-to-end of the process and all the different ways in which people are using these systems and what they're using them for. And so I worked on that project for the better part of most of the time that I was there, so about 18 months. And we had a lot of, probably 3 or 4 months of discovery time, which kind of worked out because we got lucky in the cadence of the way that the project was working. But we were able to partner with some pretty deep human factors researchers folks and go out into the field. And so we went to recruiters' offices, we went off to boot camp and looked at what that was like and how we followed the paperwork through the process of kind of day one to the end of the process when somebody is getting off a bus and essentially becoming a member of the United States military. And so that was super interesting to see. And you can follow that thread all the way through forward to some of the other projects that we've done. You know, we're on the other side, we do a lot of work at the Veterans Administration. And so you're seeing, you know, what the beginning stages of somebody's military service record, and then you're seeing kind of the end stages of that as well. And so it's nice for us to be able to get to be in all of these different places and to see the impact of that work over time, and also the value of why, you know, you would want your records to be electronic and safe and easily updatable throughout the course of somebody's time in service. And so that was one that I got to work with directly on. Another project that we worked with worked on during that time was the process that is behind when military service members and their families move. So every couple of years, you get re-detailed into a different location. And that means that not just the service person, but their spouse, their family, their small children also need to move and are impacted by moving. And it doesn't matter if it's just moving to a different town in the US, or if you're moving completely across the country or to another country to do the work that they're doing, you don't want to be stressed out about knowing where your couch is or making sure that your kids have the supplies that they need in time to start school in a new school district, in a new place. And so those were kind of examples of some of the work that we did in service to supporting the service members that are working for the Department of Defense.
Yeah, and you know, I think this is like, these are just great examples of the beauty of user-centered design, right? Like, not only is it an efficient method of building a good product, you know, whether it's software or hardware, but also being able to be close to the people and see like the impact that it's making on their lives. Like, I'm pretty sure that's very rewarding.
Yeah, it can also be really frustrating when you see the impact that it has when things don't work well. And so I think that that's a big, that drives a lot of the folks that we have here doing this work that we're doing, is that you know, everybody comes through our door wanting to be able to make a difference in some capacity, mm-hmm. but really seeing the impact when something doesn't work is really, it can garner a lot of strong feelings.
I'm sure. Yeah. And so you talk about, you know, people coming through the door, you know, wanting to make a huge impact. You know, I'm curious to know, what does the average day look like for you as the director of design at the USDS?
Yeah. So as somebody who was an individual team member during the first beginning of my time, I did a lot of project work, right? So it was lots of going to meetings and a lot of doing things like facilitating design thinking workshops and helping teams figure out what they were going to work on, and then going out into the field, as I said, and talking to people. In this role as design director, primarily what I'm doing is empowering the designers who are on the ground doing that work. And so I spend a lot of time talking with people, doing one-on-ones. I spend a lot of time looking at how we are resourcing different skill sets on different projects. And so, and then, you know, we have the added factor where we have nobody who comes here stays here forever. And so we always have new people coming in. We have people deciding to graduate and move on. And so managing, making sure that the teams that they are working on are still supported with the expertise that we have. And we've got about 35-ish designers at any given time in this generation. And so some of them are just starting out and some of them have been here for a while, and just finding, like, understanding the skill sets that each person has as a designer, and then how to best put them into situations where they can sing and do their best work is, you know, both a big challenge but also one of the great pleasures of my role. And so it's a little bit different every day. And then added to that, you know, given where we are in working for the White House, there's a lot of interest in the kinds of work that we're doing that comes from all over. So sometimes it'll be a group of high school students who are interested in visiting the White House. And so we'll spend an hour talking to them about what it is that we do, or that'll be folks from a state that is maybe spinning up a state digital service, and they're interested in learning from what we've done at the federal level to see if they can take some of those lessons and apply them. So it's talking to lots of different kinds of people at different levels throughout the day, but it keeps it really interesting. And it's a lot of fun for me to have the opportunity to talk a lot about the great work that the designers that we have are doing.
That's awesome. And are there any opportunities where our listeners can get involved with the USDS or learn more about the work?
Yeah, so we have a website, usds.gov, where you can go and see some of the work and learn about the people. We've got profiles of some of our current folks, as well as our alumni. We have some social feeds where we talk a little bit about what we're doing and post photos and that sort of stuff. And then we also are always looking for people. And, you know, we care a lot about, as small a team as we are, we care a lot about diversity, because, you know, the work that we are doing is in service to all of the different kinds of people that are living in America. And so it matters to us that we have those folks represented on the teams that we are working on. And so it can be a really wonderful place to be, and we are always looking for people to come and join us.
That's awesome. So we'll have the information that Kat just talked about on our website, guys, and immediately below in the podcast details. But Kat, our last question of the day is, in your career, you know, you've had so many different, you know, career opportunities and experiences. What advice can you give to our listeners, to the women around the globe who are trying to discover and find the right path for their career?
Yeah, I think, you know, something that I wish that I had learned a little sooner is to think about how you're, you know, constantly be thinking about the story that you're telling and the story that you want to be able to tell about the work that you're doing, regardless of what that work is. And so as a designer, it's good to give young designers the advice of be thinking about how you're going to tell the story in your portfolio later when you embark on something. And it doesn't mean that you shouldn't, not do a project because it isn't important to you in some other capacity. But I do think that sometimes, I think that I have stayed in places sometimes or on projects or doing work that maybe I would have left a little bit sooner if I had been thinking about the impact that I was having or the work that I wanted to do. And you can't always do that, right? The reality of women in technology is that sometimes you don't have a lot of options at the job or on the path that you're on. And so I do think that being realistic about what you're getting out of the experience that you're having and whether or not that's going to help you in the next thing that you do is a nice way to kind of level set and just take your own temperature about the work that you're doing.
Kat, that is some good advice that I am going to take and apply for myself. thank you so much for, providing all of, sharing with us all of your experience. We're just so grateful to have you on the show today.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Awesome. And you guys, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we will talk with you next week. Today was Kat Jurek. She was our special guest, Director of Design for the United States Digital Service. This is Ariana signing out.